The UK Investor Magazine podcast is brought to you in association with Oanda, the broker of choice for traders who want a smarter way to trade. Trade with Oanda and get 1 year's subscription to TradingView Pro. 76.6% of retail investor accounts lose money when trading CFDs with this provider. You should consider whether you understand how CFDs work and whether you can afford to take the high risk of losing your money.
Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a look at a number of UK equities and looking at the key market themes out there at the moment. And to do that, we're very kindly joined once more by Alan Green. Alan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Good morning, John. Good to be back.
So, Alan, we're looking at a FTSE 100 here, which is up at the time of recording 0.4% on the day. This is the first positive day that we're seeing in London's leading index for some time, certainly this week. And it's been very much down to the wranglings that we've been experiencing in Washington over the debt ceiling. This, of course, has been something that's been on the horizon for some time now. But as we move up to that date, which is actually just in a couple of days now, when effectively the US government would start to shut down their departments, they'd be curtailed in terms of the spending that they'd be able to make if that debt ceiling wasn't increased. We've seen this before. We get right up to the date and we get an agreement. So it's been approved by the House of Representatives. Now I think it's just the formalities that we need to go through now before that's actually approved and avoided. So that's the reason why we've seen such a sharp sell-off of late. But you know, with that news overnight, we're seeing a relief rally. Of course, it isn't recovering all of the losses that we've seen this week. There's a few other factors at play that we'll go into and also get your views on, Alan. So just looking here, it's been quite a busy week on the economic front. We saw some data from China yesterday, which was a little bit disappointing. We saw the manufacturing sector contract faster than expected. That saw some downside in miners yesterday. But moving to today, we are seeing positivity, and it's not just from the sentiment around the debt ceiling. We've seen Eurozone inflation slip, so that's helping sentiment. But I think the most important thing that we're going to discuss today is to do with the UK markets, and the most UK-centric data that we've got is data on house prices. So data from Nationwide shows that in the month to May, UK house prices fell 0.1% after rising 0.4% in April. Year on year, house prices have declined 3.4% to the month of May. But we're looking at the house builders now, Alan. It's a sector that we discuss regularly on the podcast, but it's one of the main barometers of sentiment around the UK economy. Just looking here, for example, at Persimmon, currently trading at about £12. This is a stock that's trading at £14 not too long ago. During that period, we've had markets pricing in higher rates going forward. You know, markets are now expecting that the Bank of England are going to be increasing rates to 5.5% from the current level of 4.5%. And that was really the reason for the drop that we saw throughout the month of May in house builders. But Alan, looking at these house builders now, looking at the prices that they're at and looking at how they've reacted, they're actually positive on the day. Do you feel that there again is a large element of this bad news around the housing market being priced in already to house builders?
It certainly looks that way, John. I mean, I'm just looking at a table of the performance of house builder, World Big Four, Taylor, Wimpey, Persimmon, Barrett and Barclays over the past year. And Persimmon certainly has been the best performer of the four. But as you'd expect, the charting performance is very similar. And I think going back to last year when the Bank of England governor promised, or he didn't promise, he forecast that interest rate rises would peak at about 4.5%. And of course, that doesn't seem to be happening. The recession, the interest rate increases do seem set to continue. So we've seen house price or the prices of house builders come off on the back of that in recent months. And of course, over the uncertainty with, as you've already said, the US debt ceiling and issues over inflation. But of course, we've European inflation data is now coming down, which is good news. And one would hope that the UK would start to exhibit the same characteristics when we get that data through. So of course, you know, the markets, as they do, continue to climb this wall of worry. But we've seen the collapse in the FTSE over the past week with this cocktail of bad news. So I think we're going to see that ground recovered in the coming weeks. But I mean, given what the US debt ceiling is, the US debt levels are now at $31 trillion, which is just the most unthinkable amount of money. It's almost, some might say, it's like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, you've got this this massive issue that won't go away. It's always the elephant in the room, and it's just a question of rehashing and managing as can be done. And I'm reminded of the old adage that if you owe the bank £10,000, it's your problem. If you owe the bank £2 million, it's their problem. And this is a situation where really all they can do is just make shapes on the side, you know, whilst they have this huge debt mountain. So regardless, the U.S. economy is still an absolute powerhouse. And of course, we look to that economy to provide guidance and visibility going forward. For the UK and particularly house builders, I think they're starting to look like value now. You know, you can't keep a good housing market down, and the UK housing market is one of the most buoyant in the world. And we've seen really slow growth this year, and it's noticeable. You know, we're seeing houses for sale around where we are. Last year they'd be snapped up. Now they're still on the market. They've been on for 3 or 4 months, and little's happening. But certainly, you know, we're selling. My mother is selling her house. That's now sold slightly under what we wanted, but not too far under. So, you know, the market's still very buoyant.
Indeed, indeed, and certainly looking at that reaction in the house builders this morning, there is an element I feel that, as you mentioned, Alan, that people look at this sector and they look at the value there. You know, yes, things may get worse later on in the year. I mean, it's anyone's guess as to where house prices actually go to. But looking at how this sector has moved over the last 2 years and the value some of these house builders have given up after this period, I think there's an argument there to be had that a lot of the bad news is already priced in. And what's particularly interesting about this sector is it's particularly high beta. It moves a lot faster than the market, and it's a very good gauge of what the market is actually thinking about the UK economy. Mm. So that filters down not only into the house builders, but of course other sectors within the FTSE 100. It's interesting to note that we've seen some real mixed performances from some of the UK retailers. Yesterday we saw a bumper set of results from B&M European Value. So that suggests that, you know, people do have interest within UK focused assets still. You know, there's a lot of bad news out there, and one would think that it's all doom and gloom. But there is value within these companies. And when we get good sets of results, and when we get reasonably okay data, we see some good moves. The UK shouldn't be written off at this point in time.
Just a point on the house builders again, John. Of course, these all the big four and the FTSE 250 and the smaller ones all have these land banks too, which they've invested in over the years. So they're very well positioned. So when the market does pick up again, they can land banks that might have been sitting dormant for a number of years, they can tap into those and then start building on those land banks that, of course, they picked up for far lower sums of money years ago. So, you know, all the way through, the companies are very much these big house builders are very much hedged against a downturn in the economy, because they do have that luxury of having the land bank to go back to when times are more prosperous.
Indeed. As you say, some of those plots have been picked up for very good prices in the past, and are just sitting there waiting for the right time to be developed. And of course, that does help the house builders' margins, when we see an uptick in house prices. So moving on now, Alan, the first company we're going to discuss today is Greatland Gold. So just looking at the news flow over the last year or so, it's really been dominated by the updates on drilling at Havarian. Of course, their joint venture in Australia. But over the past week, just looking here, there's been some deal making going on at Greatland Gold, which is particularly interesting. We're going to cover that today. Got the share price moving. So what's been happening there?
It's a great company, this joint. It really is, and very well run by Chief Executive Sean Day. The eponymous Havarian asset, which won the 2021 Commodity Discovery Award, and I think is really, over the past few years, been a benchmark for discoverers. If the mining company you're invested in made a discovery, wouldn't it be nice to have it as a Havarian style discovery? But of course, Greatland is anything but a one trick pony. It has a number of other assets across the Paterson area, Paterson South, and also the Jury asset, which is a joint venture with Newcrest. And I'm not going to go into details on those particular joint ventures, but as you pointed out, John, the Havarian asset that the company's been drilling over the past year just seems to grow and grow, as it is often the way when an asset is discovered, it's drilled, and then the area of strike, once you're in the ground, you realize that, or the geologists realize that it actually extends further than was originally thought. And of course, further surveys, further drilling work, further sampling work is done to get a picture of the enlarged asset. And Havarian has just been the gift that keeps on giving in that regard. They've increased the mineral resource estimate on a number of occasions. And of course, this is a hugely successful joint venture for the company with Newcrest Mining, and the company. The company, of course, has a market capitalization currently of $405 million. So it's well back from those heady days when it was somewhere in the region of $1.5 billion. But of course, that was during COVID when gold precious metal assets were valued higher than they are today. But there's been some interest, even though the commodity and mining market has been very depressed of late. We've seen some real interest in Greatland over the past few days, and for good reason. So the company announced a few days ago it had signed a commitment letter for a $220 million 7-year debt and funding facility with a banking syndicate, which is Australian and New Zealand Banking Group, HSBC and ING. So a syndicate of banks have come behind Greatland Gold to support the work that they're doing there, and of course that will see the delayed feasibility study completed, also the mining decline work will continue to advance until, of course, they're actually right on top of the asset that was originally drilled. And as Sean Day said, demonstrates the strength of the relationship that Greatland has with its banks and the financial flexibility that the company has for funding of the Havarian copper and gold project. So that, of course, was the first spur in the share price, if you like. Then, of course, the company announced a farm-in with Rio Tinto for the Paterson South tenure. And of course, Paterson South is sort of somewhere in the vicinity of the Havarian and the Winu deposit, and that's Rio Tinto's Winu deposit. So the farm and a joint venture arrangement with Rio is really another Javier and Newcrest joint venture so again, you know, this has added, I believe, huge value, because you've got a company with Rio's resources coming in, doing the heavy lifting, and of course getting Jury over the line. And it's a, you know, Sean Day said, it's an outstanding opportunity. Many, many high priority, highly prospective and heritage clear drill sites. Of course, the heritage clearances are a key part of the drilling work that's undertaken by these companies. The work, of course, is continuing there. Then, of course, the company announced today a joint venture update on the Jury asset, where Greatland has transferred the management of the Jury joint venture to its partner Newcrest Mining. And what it does, it frees up Sean and his team to focus on the really fast-tracking and developing the Paterson asset with Rio Tinto. So, you know, this is a hugely significant, it's been a hugely significant few days, I believe, for Greatland Gold. And even though the share price of mining companies is depressed at the moment, you know, we've seen a big recovery in the price over the past few days. And I think it's highly likely that, you know, as the market starts to pick up again and further news flow comes in from that joint venture with Rio, of course, Jury, then we're going to see the share price start to move up again. Also noteworthy as well on Paterson, of course, Power Metal Resources has a stake in a company called First Development Resources. FDR will be coming to market later this year, and it has a package of assets, including the Wallal Brayside assets in the Paterson region. So again, it's hugely exciting because, of course, all this is in the same region, the same areas, all this activity with Greatland, with Rio Tinto and with Newcrest. So for a company coming to market with that sort of focus and that sort of visibility, is going to be a very exciting time, I think, for investors that got in early at First Development Resources. But in regard to Greatland, I think this is a real turning point for the company, and it should have a very strong rest of year.
Yeah, certainly looking at the share price. Now, of course, this is trading within a notoriously high risk sector, of course, that the junior resource sector, and it's been depressed. You know, I don't think it's anything to do with the company as such. I think it's the wider market sentiment, but there seems to have been a bit of a base built in just beneath 7p. So it'll be interesting to see whether that level is held in the coming weeks and whether we can build a base from here for the next leg higher. So now moving on, Alan, we're going to be sticking within the resource sector and the company that we've discussed on the podcast previously, and we've had CEO Kieran Morzaria on the podcast very recently, but again, a company that's had a number of updates in recent weeks, of course, Cadence Minerals. What's the latest from them, Alan?
Well, Cadence, of course, have a portfolio of assets. They have the Amapa iron ore project in Brazil, which is a hugely important asset, formerly a producing mine. It was owned by Anglo American and Clough Mining previously. It was valued by Anglo American in 2012 at $600 million. And Cadence have really, for a song, picked up this asset, got the permission to get the show back on the road, and are currently, they have just put in place a funding package that will enable them to complete the definitive feasibility study and really get the mine recommissioned and back working again. And this is, you know, the scale of this asset has to be really understood. It's a huge working iron ore mine. It has its own railway that goes direct to the port at Santana in Brazil. It has its own port, and there at that port, of course, Cadence has, and it's through its locally owned company, Dev Minerals, it has been shipping iron ore pellets directly from that port around the world. So this mine is coming back into production, but it's coming back with a product that's already used and is already highly prized by steel smelting companies around the world. So it's shipped that product all over the world already or shipped from the tailings. So this is going to come back on stream very shortly. So Cadence has put in place an initial $2 million, and that will rise. They have a further $8 million to tap into over the next few years. So this is incredibly good news. You know, the risk on this asset is reducing all the time. But of course, given that we're in these rubbish markets at the moment, the share price hasn't reacted at all. If anything, it's gone slightly the other way, because I think you know, people are just selling into any news. But so if we take that asset as it is, once this DFS is complete and once the funding package has been fully utilized, Cadence will own up to 33% of the mine. Bearing in mind there was a hike in the mineral resource estimate earlier this year too, the mineral resource estimate is greater than now than it was when it was owned by Anglo American and valued at $600 million. So even taking that valuation, 33% of that sort of valuation gives you some idea of the massive disparity in Cadence's market cap and the value of the Amapa asset. But it's not just that. Cadence has a number of other assets it's invested into. It has 6.8% of European Metals Holdings, that is the owner jointly with CEZ Utilities of the Sinovec lithium and tin project in Czechoslovakia. That recently announced testing of lithium had confirmed that the grade was exceptionally high, suitable for batteries. So Sinovec looks set to become the next lithium battery hub for European vehicle EV manufacturers, which is you know, a huge step forward. The company also owns assets, the Mexilit and Megalit assets. It has a stake in those two companies, which are on the Sonora lithium assets, the Sonora lithium mine in Mexico. That's, of course, owned by the Chinese company Ganfeng. There'll be developments there, no doubt, as we go forward. Plus, the company also has, it owns nearly 9% of Evergreen Lithium, EG1 is the epic code, which has just listed on the Australian ASX exchange. So not nearly 9% of that. And there's been a lot of updates from Evergreen over the past few weeks. The Kenny project, it's the company announced a few days ago that had identified rare earths as well as the lithium asset, as the lithium that had already been identified there. But today, more significantly, at its Bino project, which is contiguous with Core Lithium's Finnis project. This is a lithium project which has a total mineral resource of 30.6 million tons at 1.3% lithium oxide. So the Bino project is contiguous. In other words, the anomalies run through both. It announced today that it had identified significant northeast trending lithium anomalies, several kilometers long, and they include the geochemical pathfinder elements of beryllium, cesium, potassium, lanthanum, rubidium, tin, and of course tantalum. So you know, the head of exploration was remarkably muted in his comments, but he just said, as to the geochemical picture at Bino, and indicates very large zones of lithium anomalies. So that's very encouraging news. Also, as I say, Cadence's stake in the company owns just under 16 million shares, equivalent to 8.74% of Evergreen's issued capital, and that makes Cadence Evergreen's largest shareholder. So you add the value of those assets together, and then you look at Cadence's market cap of 15.2 million. There is a massive disparity here, and at some stage, once the mining sector picks up, that will be addressed.
Thank you very much. I mean, just a couple of questions there on the Evergreen Lithium project. So actually, it's a standalone company. That's IPO'd recently, Alan. Would you be able to give us an update on how that's performed? Kieran mentioned it on the podcast and explained it had done quite well. Would you be able to give a bit of background on, you know, how that's performed since it came to market in Australia recently?
Yep. So the company currently has a market capitalization of 21.9 million Aussie dollars. So that's about, I'm guessing that's about 14 million sterling. So, you know, Cadence's stake there is nearly 9%. So that's probably 1.3 million ish. Since the company came to market, it's really performed in line with a lot of other companies that have IPO'd recently. We've seen, of course, spoke about First Class Metals and Gold Metal Resources. You know, the shares have come to market, not really done a great deal, but it's trading at 0.4 Australian dollars. So that's against a high of 69 cents and a low of 28 cents. So just off the lows, hasn't really done anything yet, but I would expect the news today, certainly on the news yesterday, the shares rose 6.7%. So the rises should be reflected in the Cadence share price, but as of yet, that has yet to happen. So I'm sure, you know, valuation always out eventually, and there is a disconnect in the markets at the moment, which I'm certain will be addressed.
Thank you very much. We're going to move on now, Alan, and finish off with True Spine, one that we spoke about on the podcast recently, but there's been some developments looking here at the company. Be able to give us a rundown of those, please?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, True Spine has a very small market capitalization at the moment. It's listed on the Aquis Exchange, and the company, as the share price has really fallen from 10p a year ago down to a penny today. That gives the company a market cap of 1.2 million. But go to the True Spine website, look at the products they have. They have spinal stabilization products, one of which is being progressed for approval through the US FDA. And it's hugely important. You know, a lot of people with back problems, you can really look and read about these and read about these products, and they speak for themselves. It's a very illustrations and graphics on that page very clearly explain what each product does. So I'm not going to go into those now. What I'm going to just discuss is a result yesterday of the general meeting that was requisitioned by shareholders in the USA, who basically wanted to turn the company into something else and really remove the value or the inherent value that's in and owned by True Spine. I have spoken about this on several occasions. I also interviewed Chief Executive Lawrence Strauss, and Lawrence was just very, very frank about the way the company had performed over the past year, what he'd been brought in to do, and of course having to deal with this issue of the shareholders requisitioning a vote to remove him from the board, which, you know, I said to him in the interview it seems odd that that you arrived as MD at the end of February and then you're appointed chief executive in April, and all the damage to the share price happened before your tenure, and yet they're trying to get rid of you now. You know, it's it doesn't seem to make sense. And the requisition letter outlined the idea to turn the company into an oil and gas company, and of course that was soundly rejected by the shareholders in the vote yesterday. Although one motion was carried, and that was that the adjourned 2022 annual general meeting be reconvened as soon as is practically possible, which probably is going to be a good thing to settle and give clarity to this matter once and for all. But you know, Lawrence said in the announcement yesterday he was pleased that those resolutions have been defeated, and he hopes that now as a company they can draw a line under the matter and move forward so the company can take the steps it needs to do to realize the potential of the unique product portfolio. And that's what he's now doing, and I know, you know, meetings are already underway to progress that. So it's a very exciting time for True Spine shareholders because they have some fantastic IP, and frankly I'm surprised that the share price hasn't reacted more than it has done at this stage. But I'm guessing probably some shareholders are waiting to see the plans that Lawrence has, and of course we will find out about those in due course.
And when we do, I'm sure it'll be something that we discuss on the podcast. So Alan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, John.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by Oanda, TradingView's most popular broker. Trade with Oanda and get 1 year subscription to TradingView Pro. 76.6% of retail investor accounts lose money when trading CFDs with this provider. You should consider whether you understand how CFDs work and whether you can afford to take the high risk of losing your money.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember all investment involves risk.